I think OpenAI is going to try and capture attention back away from the success of Gemini. They've got to do that to, you know, save face with their broader investors and everything else they're pursuing. But I don't know that I would agree that at the end of the day, the consumer is going to be a lot better off the day after 5.2 is released than today.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Hwang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the smartest minds in technology to distill down what's important in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists. We've got Mihai Crivetti, Distinguished Engineer, Agentic AI, Kate Soll, Director, Technical Product Management, Granite, and Ami Ganesan, Partner, AI and Analytics. Welcome to you all. We're really ending the year with a bang. There's a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk a little bit about rumors of GPT 5.2, a new transparency report out of Stanford, and Amazon's newest generation of their Nova models. But first, we've got Eily with the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eily McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. Here are a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. Both Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are now racing to develop data centers in space. IBM has acquired data streaming platform Confluent for $11 billion to help ramp up agent use in enterprises. OpenAI has started training models to confess when they've made stuff up or taken shortcuts. Ho, ho, ho. A new Santa agent lets users interact with Santa via text, phone, or video chat to share what they want for Christmas and to find out if they're on the naughty or the nice list. For more, subscribe to the Think newsletter, linked in our show notes. And now let's see what our experts think of ChatGPT 5.2.
This is kind of an interesting story. Rumors are swirling, and by the time you listen to this, this model actually may be out, that effectively OpenAI has called a code red to get its GPT 5.2 model out to go compete largely with the new Google model, Gemini, which indeed, as we've talked about before in previous episodes, is very, very impressive. And I mean, maybe I'll start with you. This is sort of a really interesting kind of reversal in some ways. Had we talked about it in January 2025, it would have been like OpenAI is crushing everybody. They've got the state of the art models. They're ahead of everyone else. No one's catching up. But this is kind of weirdly now in a situation where it's like Google, which we would have said at the beginning of the year is like the most behind, is now the one that's kind of causing OpenAI to react. And I don't know, is this just gossip? Like, are we reading too much into this? Or is it really kind of a signal that OpenAI is in some ways falling behind in this race?
Yeah, look, I think we can speculate all we want. History always suggests that there's always going to be this up and down roller coaster, right? I feel like if you made this entire saga movie, it's going to be full of plot twists and turns. Yeah. So much that you're going
who
to be on this.
Who plays Demis? You know, who plays Sam? Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's anybody's guess. So, yeah, of course, rumors are swelling. And I think the latest I read that was, 5.2 is already on Cursor. There are indications that may release soon, right? It's not just 5.2. There's Chestnut and Hazelnut as well accompanying it. Code names for a couple of the image in models to, compete with Nano Banana Pro. So, yeah, of course, I think it's anybody's game at this point in time. We can speculate all we want, but hey, at the end of the day, consumers are winner here, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, welcome all the competition, all the good competition between the model makers.
You're happy for the soap opera, let's keep basically.
Pushing. Yeah, that's exactly.
Right. Kate, would love to get your reaction on this because I feel like at the end of this year, I'm tired. You know, it's like every week there's a new model out, or it's like, what's the difference between this model and that model? But do like model launches matter anymore? Like, should we care about them?
Yeah.
Or is like the game really somewhere else now?
And I actually wonder, I don't know if I quite agree, Ami, with your statement, the consumer wins at the end of this. Like, are we really in this race where the consumer is actually benefiting? Am I going to have this like huge uptick in my productivity and daily life with 5.2? I don't think so. Not for the potential costs that will come along with it, but we can always see. I think there definitely is a little bit of exhaustion that's coming in just broadly around model releases. And so I think OpenAI is going to try and capture attention back away from the success of Gemini. They've got to do that to, save face with their broader investors and everything else they're pursuing. But I don't know that I would agree that at the end of the day, the consumer is going to be a lot better off the day after 5.2 is released than today.
Yeah, so I get where Kate is coming from, right? But the way I look at it is at the end of the day, advances are going to keep coming. They're going to keep coming, right? And what I mean by the consumer is going to win is that keep those advances coming. You don't want things to stagnate, right? That's the only way. So have that competition flowing, have that healthy competition flowing. So you keep advancing the boundaries, you keep pushing the boundaries. And so at the end of the day, as consumers of those models, right? Yeah, there may not be dramatic changes, but every win counts, right? So you keep pushing the boundary, you keep pushing the boundary, and that's how the field advances. So at the end of the day, that healthy competition is great, right? You got to have that.
Miha, do you want to get in on this? Do you feel, do you have any opinions on a model that is not yet out? Is this going to be the model that crushes everything for the year or?
I'm about as excited about this model as I am for the latest Windows or Mac OS hotfix. You know, you see it in the Windows update.
Wow,
and
that
you're
is
like,
harsh. I was joking recently. I was like, they just dropped a new version of Zoom recently. Who's excited about the new Zoom version?
Yay! So,
yeah,
I guess. My take is this. Many of these models are going to see minor updates that try to resolve issues with performance, with speed, with cost, with specialized use cases, with usage in, for example, IDEs like Cursor or in Codecs or the equivalent of Cloud Code. They're going to try to optimize for specific benchmarks or for specific situations. But I don't expect these updates to be necessarily revolutionary. They just put maybe OpenAI for the next 2 days, 2 hours, 2 minutes, 2 months, if they're lucky, ahead of Gemini in some of these specific benchmarks. Is it going to be world-changing? Likely not. It's nice, it's maintenance, it's going to help with some of the specialized use cases, but I don't think it's going to be revolutionary. Otherwise, they would have called it GPT-6.
Yeah, versus 0.2, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of one of the really interesting sort of ironies of, it feels like the situation we're sitting in at the end of 2025 is like, everybody kind of agrees there's something like, kind of rotten in the world of benchmarks, right? Like, they don't really provide us with a whole lot of traction on what we actually want to use these tools for. As yet, clearly, they are motivating a lot of big corporate activity, right? Like, OpenAI wants to be number one on all those benchmarks, and it doesn't want to be left behind for any length of time when, you know, Gemini comes out and, like, says, hey, we're great against all these benchmarks. But it's almost like we're almost optimizing for the same thing. And it feels like you end up kind of in this discussion that Ambi and Kate were just having, which is, well, there's these maybe downstream effects where everybody sort of benefits from us constantly pushing the frontier. The other one is also kind of like, is the industry focusing on the right thing, right? Because I think, you know, Kate, I guess you're nodding. I don't know if you want to respond to that idea.
Well, I think what's really interesting, a week or two ago, Stanford's Hazy Lab put out a report looking at the intelligence per watt, basically, and how much performance we're being able to drive per kind of watt of electricity powering the compute. And what they found is that, you know, a lot of the adoption and market share is with these big hosted models, like, you know, the latest GPT models. But that if you actually look at what you can achieve if you move some of those workloads locally, you can get the same amount of performance at a lot lower energy consumption, a lot lower cost. And so, you know, I think they argue that there's a huge opportunity for disruption here, that, you know, the model providers might not be focused on the right metrics. And I would tend to agree with that. I think that right now we're, you know, chasing a lot of investment dollars and prioritizing fancy benchmarks. But a lot of the future development is going to be incentivized more by performance per cost. And you don't see that quite in the conversation today with these model releases that are coming out.
One angle I want to bring to this before we move on to the next topic is, Ambi, you work with a lot of like customers and enterprise, right? And, you know, I think all of this comes on the backdrop of like, these companies are obviously ultimately competing for enterprise dollars. And so I guess I'm curious, just like, because I genuinely don't know, like one of these new models drops like 5.2, are customers like, oh man, this one's launching on all the benchmarks. I got to move my entire stack over to the new model. Like, what's the influence of these types of kind of competitions, even very incrementally, on who chooses to adopt what? Like, is the market influenced, I guess is what I'm saying, by these kinds of launches?
Yeah, there are two lenses in which you look at it, right? Enterprises are not going to immediately switch to the latest model at the drop of a hat, right? So you pick a stable workhorse, you build your applications on top of that. You got to have some stability there's all the, you know, you put it into production and then you start realizing value, right? It'll be very, very tricky. It'll be very, very problematic to go and keep changing problems at the drop of a hat. So, you know, it's not going to happen immediately, right? But does it happen? Of course, it'll happen, right? Because let's say you track it over the period of time, right? Let's say you're tracking things over the period of, and you know, 6 months, a year. And over the course of time, the pace at which these advances are happening, there is a fundamental step function change in the performance of the models, right? Bunch of new capabilities have gotten accumulated, which means, okay, now you're exploring and you're looking at, okay, you know, from a maintenance perspective, from an application maintenance perspective, I do want to have a roadmap into, okay, you know, there is a certain time window at which I say, okay, I've got a step function change and I'm going to go and make a switch to the latest model, right? So yes, those model changes will happen and do happen, but it's not going to happen for every single release that happens.
I would say the following. If you're able to switch models at the drop of a hat, either your enterprise maturity is very low, where you're an independent developer or a small shop and are able to just quickly switch models, or your maturity is very high, where you have all of your evals fully automated and you're able to switch the model. You push a button, all your evals get done, you can test your request on the new model, and then you're able to see, oh yeah, this one performs 17.3% better for my use case. It's more cost effective. I see the data in my observability platform in my dashboard. I make the switch overnight. So if you're in the middle, it's going to be tough.
Well, we'll just have to see. I guess this announcement 5.2, I'm sure we'll be talking about it potentially next week when it actually launches, and we'll see how all these predictions play out. But I think that's really interesting. And I think, Ambi, Meha, it's, I think, very helpful to have this discussion on just like, so much of this is like, we see the competition, but it's also on the backdrop of the customers and just seeing kind of what they do or how they react to this stuff. Yeah. Meha, sorry.
I'm just hoping OpenAI is going to do the 12 days of Christmas thing again, like what was it, last year?
You like that. That was a good gimmick from last 5.2, year.
5.2, 5.3, 5.4, one model release every day.
Yeah, exactly. Until we get to 5.12 and then they'll roll
exactly.
over to 6.
You just tweak the prompt every day and you call it a 5.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. So we've talked about this report before, but a number of researchers at Stanford have come out with the latest edition of their transparency index. And so if you're not familiar with this discussion from last year, the idea is that they're taking a bunch of available models and trying to rank and assess basically how well these models do from the point of view of transparency, right? What kinds of documentation do they provide? What kinds of data disclosures do they have? And I've always thought of this as like a very interesting project because when we say transparency, it's a little bit like open source, right? Or it's like, what do we exactly mean by that? And these are attempts, I think, to kind of get a lot more granular about, you know, what we mean when we say transparency. And Kate, it was good to have you on the show because I understand Granite was a part of this transparency report. And do you want to just talk a little bit about how you all kind of approached it and how it all turned out?
Yeah, so this is a report, as you mentioned, that Stanford does annually. We've participated in the past, and it really tries to break down model development into three components. So kind of upstream, the model training itself, and downstream of the model. And what they do is they send a survey out to model developers like IBM, training our Granite models, both closed and open model developers. And they invite people to participate and share information about everything, you know, upstream of model development, like around data curation, what models are you using to generate data to train on your models downstream, to the actual training process. You know, do you release your training code? Do you release different repositories? Do you release different details about the architecture of the model? And then downstream of model use, so things around like, do you release benchmarks on safety? Do you release details on gaps and performance? Do you release prompts that were successfully used to attack the model? So that type of thing. And, you know, what they've done and found is that over the years, you know, transparency has actually greatly diminished. If you look between 2024 in this report that just came out last week, in 2025, there's a most labs have reduced the degree that they are quote unquote transparent, so the degree that they share details about these different facets of model development. IBM's taking a very different approach, which I'm really proud of. really focusing on transparency and trust and being as open as possible. I think it speaks to the rigor of which we put together our strategy and policies around how we train and develop our models, which is reflected in our ISO 42001 certification that we also received this year. And it allows us to just be very forthcoming with what we're working on, how we're building it, and how we're contributing it to the open source ecosystem. So we're really proud that Granite got the top score, 95 out of 100, I believe, and where other labs were kind of going down in transparency over time, you know, IBM demonstrated that we are actually doubling down and increasing the degree of which we're transparent in model development.
Yeah, and that's 95 out of 100, like, different criteria, basically.
Yes, exactly. Different indicators, different questions. Yeah. Do we answer and provide detail? So it's not actually looking at, you know, what was the result on this safety benchmark? It's how transparent are you on your safety benchmarks? Do you share the benchmarks? Do you share this type of data? Which is a really cool approach.
And I think one of the things I want to, if you could speak a little bit more about it, is, you know, especially because across 100 of these metrics, you know, you have to almost pick and choose, right? Like, the team can't afford to try to do everything or move everything forwards on a year-to-year basis. Or maybe that is how the team is thinking about it. I guess I'm interested in whether or not there's, like, particular aspects of transparency that the team said, okay, this year is what we're really going to prioritize.
Yeah. So I think over the past year and a half, if you look at from where we were in 2024 to 2025, we've done a lot of work on automating and standardizing our training and development process so that there are automated records of everything that makes it much easier to be transparent and share, because there's so many minute details that go into these models. Everything from, you know, when was a data set acquired and what was the license it was acquired on and what was the source it was acquired and what was the review process for it. And so we actually invested heavily in the architecture around all of that data curation and training so that we can have a very streamlined, you know, lineage of our models that makes it really easy to just be transparent and open and have that information at our fingertips. That also helps us with our own regulatory compliance requirements, where we want to be obviously best in class and able to respond to changing regulations as they evolve. And that made it possible for us to be just a lot more open when it came to the transparency index this year.
If I can bring you in, I mean, I think Kate's already pointing out, I think, one of the interesting trends, right, which is obviously Granite doubled down on this, but the general trend is less transparency that we're seeing. And, you know, this actually goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about, like, what the market incentivizes. You know, how I read the transparency index is it's sort of a dream of saying, look, people will be able to look at the index and say, I want the more transparent model. Here's how I find that, right? And the market will reward people who are more transparent. But if anything, it feels like there's actually been a pullback on transparency. Do you think that means that the market doesn't really value transparency all that much?
I think it depends on the type of business they serve. So I've noticed in the report that B2B, for example, companies tend to be more transparent than B2C, because regular consumers may not care if they're running a 100 billion, 200 billion, 500 billion parameter model, how many GPUs it uses, how much water or whatever other metric, CO2 emissions are used in the model. They may not necessarily care about the cost to run the model itself. They care about the cost to the end user. While B2B companies do need to care if they make these models available to other companies who are consuming it, who may be running it on their own infrastructure. The second interesting trend I've seen is like you've pointed out, it went from 74% of the companies responding last year to only 30% responding this year. So models, it's kind of curious if you look, you know, X.AI models or models from Anthropic, models from OpenAI, you don't even know how many billion parameters they have. And you might not care. I would see it from one perspective. This kind of information can be used against them. Oh, look how much, you know, CO2 or emissions this model is generating, or how inefficient it is. It can be used in calculating how viable their business is long term. So, for example, are they actually subsidizing a lot of their end users? So a lot of this information I see is likely to become more transparent in B2B companies. So, you know, AWS with their Nova models and IBM with their Granite models and NVIDIA and so on and so forth are going to become likely more transparent over time. While models that are focused more on the consumer market don't necessarily need to publish those details. They probably will not publish them anymore.
Ambi, it almost feels like there's going to be like on the consumer side, almost like the Appleification of the world. Kind of what I mean by that is like, if you go back 20 years, right, it'd be like, okay, well, we have these open computing platforms and you've got Apple, and it's a battle between open and closed. And then over time, it kind of feels like everybody has been like, yeah, actually, like for the consumer, the general preference is they're happy to pay more for a pretty closed system that's pretty opaque. You know, you have to go to a store and find a genius to fix these computers for you. That's kind of like the state of play in consumer land. And then on enterprise, of course, open source has this like long and robust legacy and is a huge, huge, huge business. Do you sort of see that happening in the world of kind of AI applications as well, where it's like, it turns out that from a consumer standpoint, transparency is not so important that it really is encouraging companies like Anthropic and OpenAI to say, hey, we're going to participate in this index and we're going to try to get a good score on this index?
Well, partially, right? See, I always say that at the end of the day, we all sit in enterprises, but then we are also consumers, right? So at the end of the day, we all wear those two hats at the same time. So, it's not like, we just immediately switch on and off between a consumer hat and an enterprise hat, right? Like even when we're sitting in an enterprise, we think with a consumer lens and vice versa. So I think some of those, the ways we think bleed into each other's domains, right? This is what I've noticed, right? I feel like the market in general is maybe asking the wrong questions, right? So yes, there is the prioritization on IP, which is why you see, in these benchmarks, most of the labs, if you look at the downward trend on the metrics, right? There was a huge hit on the upstream component, right? I don't think there isn't necessarily a reward or whether there is a reward for labs to do it or not. I feel like the right thesis should be whether the market is asking the right question. What I mean by that is, I'll give you an example. Just earlier this week, I was with a client and they were talking about DeepSeek and asking, we want to see if we should be using open source models and, oh, what do you think about DeepSeek and should we be using that, right? Now, and this is within an enterprise setting. And we talked about some of this in one of the earlier episodes. What DeepSeek did was it opened the mindshare for open source, right? So everyone started thinking about open source models, open weight models, and started talking about it. But I think there is a conflation of transparency with open source and open weights, which is not necessarily true, right? And so I think what most consumers and most enterprises inherently are asking for are transparent models, but they are terming it and they're asking for, hey, can I get open source and open weight models? Which isn't, those two aren't necessarily the same. So, I don't fully buy the argument that, hey, the market isn't asking for or they're favoring for it. Yes, of course, there's the inherent tension between, hey, I'm going to optimize for my IP from the lab's perspective and the market saying, hey, I need some transparency. But there is definitely a demand for that transparency, I would say, right? It's just that they're asking the wrong questions, which means that the signals aren't really coming up into these reports appropriately.
Well, I will say what's interesting about the parallel you brought up, Tim, comparing to Apple, is Apple at the same time, they've taken away a lot of the configurability and user visibility into the hardware, but they also have one of the best reputations for privacy. When it comes to devices and kind of responsible use of data and information. And deservedly or not, they've kind of built a strong reputation there. And I think it is paying off with consumers. And I don't see that quite yet in model development, but I think it's going to become more and more of a priority. Transparency is one way you can indicate it. It's not the only way. Like Anthropic didn't score as well on transparency, but they have the ISO 42001 certification. And I think they're also very well known for their kind of principles in ethical AI. And so I think transparency is just one tool to kind of address some of the broader societal and ethical questions that are going to maybe not be the singular driving market factor, but will be an important market factor in the future.
No, just to add on to that, I do agree with Kate, and I do think that will become a trend. Just look back at social media as a parallel, right? So when it started with MySpace and the early days of social media, privacy wasn't probably, you know, at the center of everyone's thoughts, right? It was about the cool thing and, okay, the ability to network. So the capabilities were at the forefront. But then when these capabilities sort of matured and saturated, privacy went up front, right? So you had all the, you know, the shenanigans with Cambridge Analytica and things of that nature, you know, the Congress hearings popping up. So you started to see that pivotal shift happen. And I feel like you're going to see some of those happen with any new technology. The capabilities come up front, and then, you know, once those sort of become mainstream, you're going to start seeing some of these privacy concerns and transparency aspects come to the forefront really soon.
Kate, maybe to wrap this section up, you know, you're already scoring 95 out of 100. where do you go next year? Do you work on that last remaining five? Like, are we already kind of saturating, I guess, in some sense, the benchmark for transparency?
I think there are certainly always going to be new ways to think about transparency. We're moving from models being kind of just a bag of weights that get released in the open source, in the case of Granite at least, open weight models, to having more systems of models and software built together. And so that's going to introduce new aspects of being transparent. So being transparent, not just on the weights itself and how the weights were created, but looking at particularly around deployment and the systems and software that are executing the deployment and the details can have huge impacts on performance. And I'd love to see the transparency index evolve to encompass those aspects. I know it's certainly things that IBM's thinking about. We're also working on, you know, one project we're working on is thinking through how do you create a standardized AI bill of materials and have that more of a standard artifact that can be released with models. So I don't want to, you know, give away too much, but expect some work from IBM on that in 2026 to come out. You know, I think there's going to be a lot more look at standardization, a lot more look at deployment of these models. So still lots to do that we're eager to work on with the community.
Not done yet, for sure.
Yeah.
I'd love to see more transparency over the infrastructure as well, right? The APIs they put in front of the models.
Absolutely.
Like even the system prompt is kind of invisible. And if you're comparing the OpenAI model to ChatGPT as a end user application, there's a lot of other stuff going on in there, which is unknown.
I'm going to push us on to our final topic. The big Amazon AWS reInvent conference was just the other week. Number of really interesting announcements coming out of that we didn't get a chance to cover in the previous episodes. It occurs to me that I'm actually like running against myself now. I started the episode by being like, I'm bored of all these new model releases, and we're going to end with an Amazon release some new models. So I'm a hypocrite, I suppose. The news is, of course, the big news coming out of the conference is that Amazon announced its latest generation of Nova Frontier models. You know, I think Amazon has always been really interesting in the MOE discussion just because they've always been kind of looming in the background, right? They have huge infrastructure. They have incredible data with all the e-commerce stuff. And so it seems like very natural that at some point they would be really starting to make some very big swings in the AI space and in the model space. And Ambi, I guess the question for you is like, is this the big swing? Like Nova really feels like it's like they're really touting this as like we're now in the game. Are they in the game?
Well, I mean, there were some of the releases on Nova even last year, right? So Nova isn't like completely new. So first of all, right? So technically they're saying, hey, we were already in the game last year with the Nova releases,
<We've been here>.
Right? some of those, I think, advances are par for the course, right? So they're releasing speech-to-speech models, which others are releasing as well. So some of those, I think, are par for the course. A couple of new advances came out, which is, you know, Nova Forge, which they're touting as we're going to democratize multiple different mechanisms for you to go and build your own models. So it's not just fine-tuning mechanisms, but almost, and you know, it's still murky on exactly how they do this, but it's almost like, hey, we'll give you checkpoints and then you come and blend in with your data and then build your own custom pre-trained models from scratch, right? and we're going to democratize it. An enterprise just can go and do it. You don't have to have a complete research lab to do it. So, so there are some of those that's really exciting. The question again, you know, if I put an enterprise lens on it, great. But, you know, how many of those capabilities are going to be used for how many enterprise use cases, right? A large mainstream set of use cases will and can be largely driven with, you know, your models out of the box with appropriate integrations, and to be able to drive off of that. You may not need, you know, custom fine-tuned models or even custom pre-trained models for a good chunk of the use cases, right? So great capabilities. It's a great push on the engineering side of things, right? So it's fantastic, fantastic looking at it as an engineer. But also trying to think about, okay, you know, what's the enterprise value and how that slots in, right? There's another one on Nova Act, which is the enterprise equivalent of the OpenAI browser use or the Gemini browser use. So being able to do that, the differentiation that they talk about is, hey, now, you know, we have trained it on enterprise screens. So it's not doing it on Instacart shopping, but you're training it on CRM screens. And we think, you know, we are way more equipped to handle those sorts of enterprise screens, right? So still early days. I think that piece is actually exciting because let's all be honest, right? There's always going to be a data and API issue, and there's always going to be issues of, hey, am I having the most clean and hygienic data elements in an enterprise? There's always going to be those cases. So we're looking at and we're all thinking, hey, you know, that the browser use cases, the browser act, applications and capabilities can be fairly promising where you don't have ready access to data, right? You just sort of mimic the human actions to do it. So it's a promising capability, but then there are obviously a lot of open questions on the security of how that will work, right? Good promising, still to be seen.
I'm not a fan of training or fine-tuning models for most enterprise use cases, mostly because whenever you talk to an enterprise, they, one, assume they have data. Second, they assume they have the GPUs. And third, they assume they have the investment necessary to continuously fine-tune or to train a model every single time their data evolves or changes. The reality is that large language models on their own are insufficient for the vast majority of enterprise use cases. Why? They've been trained on last year's data, and they've been trained on public data. So you want to blend that data with your enterprise data. But we've seen techniques like RAG, GraphRAG, Agentic RAG, as well as tool use. So using MCP servers or leveraging all sorts of techniques provides sufficiently good access to real-time data and real-time information without the need for expensive tuning, training, or fine-tuning. I think the proposition is for the very, very few companies that employ, you know, hundreds of data scientists who really make it their passion to train and fine-tune models. Even if you're doing it on quote-unquote somebody else's infrastructure, even if you're not starting from scratch and you're starting from a checkpoint, you shouldn't underestimate the effort it takes to properly train or even fine-tune a model to a specific domain. And you shouldn't underestimate the vast amount of data that is required or the quality of data that is required. So I would say most folks should stick to agents. That's why I like the fact that Amazon provides a one-stop shop for everything.
Not that you're biased or anything.
So it's like, but look, they have the other option, right? They have Act, yeah, they sure. have their agent core, they have agents. You don't like this? We have that. So I would say, don't fine-tune or train a model unless you really have to and you know what you're doing. It's very unlikely that the resulting model is going to outperform a frontier model plus tool use. And even if it does, now you have to do that every single week, month, or however, whatever the refresh rate of your data is. Still exciting if you're in that space or if you're in that 1% of companies that do need that service and you can't buy the GPUs that are required for it and you need to rent that service. It's awesome.
This is actually kind of fun because I feel like it actually kind of flips the narrative from what we were talking about earlier, right? I think earlier I was like, you know, consumers, they don't want complexity. They don't want transparency. But enterprise, they do want complexity and transparency. And I think, yeah, you're coming back and basically saying, actually, for most enterprises, they don't want that either. You know, so Kate, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I agree with everything that's said. The only other comment I have to add is, where I do think there could be something interesting is really around the research and academia community when it comes to these new types of reinforcement learning as a service and tuning as a service capabilities in NovaForge. So I thought it was really cool that they're offering kind of early checkpoints. So partially trained versions of the NovaLite model that can then be further customized. So one benefit that could come out of that, while I agree, I'm skeptical on the like direct enterprise value. I think it's going to be a lot harder than people anticipate to kind of get a specialized model using SFT or RL. I do think that we could potentially, by offering more of these components, enable more engagement with academia, engagement from the research community that's otherwise kind of hampered because they don't have access to a early checkpoint. You know, they even have a part of their service where you can mix your own data with the training data for continued training. So, you know, those are all really interesting things that hopefully, you know, could spur some more innovation that, you know, the field could benefit from and engage with a new user group that's kind of been left along the sidelines and not able to participate fully.
Yeah, definitely a constituency we don't talk about enough on the show, but we should definitely talk more about it. Mihai, maybe I'll give you the final word of this episode, maybe a little bit of a peek into the future. One of the fun tidbits that Amazon announced when releasing the Nova models was, you know, they've been playing around with kind of making the claim that their frontier agents can operate for hours or even days on end. Which is, I think, very intriguing. And regardless of how credible you think that claim is, I think we are kind of headed towards this really fun world where you're like, okay, computer, I need you to help me out with something. And it comes back like 3 weeks later and is like, here's what I did. Are we headed for that world? Certainly the technology will be able to do something in those 3 weeks. But I'm kind of curious if you feel like we're finally getting these agents aligned enough to get there. Yeah.
My agents can operate for weeks on end too. It doesn't mean that I'm getting good results out of them. I mean,
actually, you can have them run for years if you want. Whether I care about the results.
It's not an issue. I actually have a timeout I can tweak. I can keep it going and going and going and never return a final answer. Just tell me how many tokens you want me to consume.
That's right.
So, look, I think what is improving is tool use. Right, what we're seeing is improvement in tool use in terms of the number of tools that can be called, the number of tools that can be called in parallel, the number of sequential tools that can be called, and techniques like MapReduce or being able to do vector search or tool search to call the right tool allows this kind of continuous use cases. So let's say you're building a document, literally building, or let's take a PowerPoint document because it's even easier to visualize, and you're building slide one, slide two, slide three, slide four. Each of those can be an independent tool call, and it can keep going and going and going if you're managing your context right. So if you think about what's preventing us from doing continuously running agents today, it's just how difficult it is to properly manage that context. You're working with a limited context of the LLM for tool orchestration. Everything needs to fit in the context within an execution, and then you need to use techniques to manage the context, how you compact it. So if you've used Cloud Code or Codex, you see at some point in time it starts to compact it. It's literally summarizing what you have in your context to a state that is good enough for it to continue from that state. So all of these techniques are coming together, and we're seeing longer and longer and longer running agents. Microsoft has Researcher. ChatGPT and Gemini have their deep research functionality. Amazon has similar techniques. We have similar techniques, and we've built our own deep researchers. I think at the end of the day, this is something we're going to see more and more. Because if you want to get good results in enterprise use cases from AI, you want it to touch all of your data. And that means hundreds, potentially thousands of tool calls. RAG is not enough. With RAG, what you're doing is you're selecting 10 paragraphs, give or take, from whatever you're searching, and then you're giving it to the model and you're hoping for the best. What I would like to do is to give it all of the data, summarize this and this and this and this and this, and keep going and going and going. it's expensive. But in some cases, if you're putting together a complex deliverable like an RFI response document, an RFP response document, a, you know, go write me a book and come back with 300 pages on this topic, you need that depth. So I do see a natural evolution of all agents within the enterprise space adopting this kind of deep researcher functionality with agents that can run for 10 minutes, an hour, perhaps even overnight, to come back with a very complex response.
Tim, I want to add a nuance to what Mihai said, and Mihai is absolutely right, right? So you have to contextualize all of this. But that's not to discount that the advances that the field is seeing, right? So, you know, it's not just, you have to look at this in two dimensions. It's not just about the amount of time that an agent or a model or system is taking. It's also when it's running for that much amount of time, how reliably or how accurate is the outcome of the task that you are accomplishing, right? That curve has definitely shifted towards the right, right? So a couple of years back, we would have said, you know, high accuracy would have been of the order of a few seconds, then it became a few minutes, and now we are definitely in the realm of a few hours, right? So the curve is definitely shifting, but, you know, it's important to recognize it's not just how long it's running, it's how long it's running and it's doing it reliably with high accuracy.
Yeah, and in the loop, evals also help with this. So if you have agents that can self-evaluate and intermediate checkpoints and retry and take different direction, then this is going to help improve them over over a longer running execution cycle.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think part of it is just going to be these like trade-offs. But I do think the frontier is going to be increasing continuously. But something to pay attention to, particularly because I think this will be the new frontier of claims being made about agents, right? You can run them for weeks. You can run them for 2 weeks. And so I think the question now will be, how do we measure that? How do we quantify that? So it'll be very interesting to see. Well, that's all the time we have for today. So Kate, Ambi, Mihai, thanks for joining us as always, and happy holidays. And thanks to all you listeners. If you liked what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.